This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Every week there are bombshells. This week, there were bombs.
At least 10 packages have been sent to people who are frequently singled out by criticism by the president.
The FBI has confirmed another package, 11th, found last night in Florida.
This is now the 12th package that's been recovered, and it has all of the hallmarks that are believed to be a serial suspected bomber.
An ardent Florida Trump supporter was arrested on charges of mailing pipe bombs to the pantheon of demonized liberals, Obama, George Soros, the Clintons among them, plus the headquarters of CNN. None of the bombs detonated, but clearly people were very shaken up live on the TV.
That means they were explosive devices. And to have projectiles, I mean, that sounds like a fire alarm here. We'll keep you posted on that.
Okay, we're going to jump in. There's a fire alarm here.
You might have heard it in the background. We're going to find out what the latest is
we'll be right back.
At CNN. We're going to be right back.
A minute later, CNN anchors Poppy Harlow and Jim Sciutto were evacuating CNN's New York headquarters along with hundreds of employees, tourists, and New Yorkers from neighboring buildings.
It was chaotic, but once the bomb squads wrapped up, everybody defaulted to their inevitable roles. Donald Trump, after first offering a boilerplate condemnation of political violence, immediately retreated to blaming the obvious culprits.
What is the first statement the president makes about this today? It's to attack the media. He says a very big part of the anger we see today in our society is caused by the purposely false and inaccurate reporting of the mainstream media that I refer to as fake news. It has gotten so bad and hateful that this is beyond description. Mainstream media must clean up its act fast.
Which blame-shifting rhetoric led to charges that the president himself incited violence with his constant vilification of Democrats in the press.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously.
The last few days, he's been calling for hatred toward exactly the groups and individuals that were just targeted.
CNN's Chris Cuomo.
When he comes out and says we need to be civil, there's no apology needed to say it doesn't ring quite true.
In short order, the speculation and accusation were reduced to right versus left. Notably, in an explanation that surprised absolutely no one, the conspiracy crowd, from Rush Limbaugh to Ann Coulter to Gateway Pundit to Lou Dobbs, blamed Democrats for a false flag operation supposedly aimed at discrediting the right in advance of the midterm elections.
I will repeat, it's a high probability that the whole thing is set up as a false flag to gain sympathy for the Democrats, number one, and number two, to get our minds off the hordes of illegal aliens approaching our southern border. Yes, that is what I'm saying.
That was Michael Savage, this from Fox News.
This doesn't necessarily mean that someone is espousing some sort of conservative ideology and targeting Democrats. It could be someone who's trying to get the Democratic vote out and incur sympathy. So, it could go either way.
And from the right-wing pundit Candace Owens, this now-deleted tweet, quote, "These leftists are going all out for midterms." Remember when things happened and it was reported about as an event? That was called news. Now we have only points of departure for the discussion of political implications. With November 6th coming and the balance of congressional power at stake, why sweat the facts? There are narratives to compare and electoral advantage to parse. It's been true of the bombs. It was true of Jamal Khashoggi's murder at the hands of our Saudi allies. It's true of the Honduran migrant caravan. As the president prepared to both send troops to the Mexican border and halt the asylum process, the New York Times observed that his posturing was taking place, quote, only days before the midterm elections. More of the same on NBC News.
What does the rhetoric that the president is invoking when it comes to this migrant caravan, what types of voters is it going to turn out or even turn?
Because we, the media, also default to our assigned role, and we can't resist our impulses either. Yes, at election time, the press seems less like an institution than an amalgamation of our own quirks. A biennial witness to this is Claire Malone of 538, who pores over both the media coverage and the polls themselves. I asked her, apart from seeing all human events through an electoral prism, what other tropes she's noticed this time around.
I think that there have been certain states that perhaps have been overcovered in this election, or maybe the candidates' odds have been amplified beyond what we would sort of give them from a, I guess, a statistical look.
Politico writes Texas has Beto mania. Esquire says he could be the next Obama. Vanity Fair calls him Kennedy-esque.
It's obviously an interesting election because he has, as a Democrat, garnered a lot of enthusiasm in a deeply red state. And for people looking at the demographics of that state and looking to see people aging into voting whose parents were immigrants, perhaps. I'm thinking of the Latino population in that state. So it's interesting for Democrats to see O'Rourke doing well. But honestly, I mean, somewhere like Tennessee, which is another deeply red state, Phil Bredesen, who is running as a Democrat there, is the former governor of the state. And I would say that the Democrats' chances in that state are much better than they are in Texas. So we have a little bit of a natural inclination towards a sexy headline, a telegenic candidate like O'Rourke. I did a piece on him a couple weeks ago, and, you know, in my lead, I talked about the number of times he's been compared to a Kennedy. People like assigning stories like that. But then you also have to say, well, let's talk to people about the actual demographics of Texas and whether or not he has as good of a chance as people might be getting the impression that he does.
In this, the Me Too era, one of the earliest narratives attached to the midterms was the Year of the Woman.
We're doing a wonderful kind of documentary story about what's now being called the Year of the Women.
It's being called a seismic shift, a record number of women running for elected office.
There are a total of 6 Democratic women in the race.
The last time that narrative was so pronounced was in 1992, when in fact the number of women in the House increased by double digits.
Is this the Year of the Women, plural, for Democrats?
So what is in fact taking place, according to your numbers, in 2018?
So there are 238 women running in total, so 186 Democrats and 52 Republicans. Basically, we've determined if every woman who's currently leading in a district were to end up winning, there would be 100 women in the House and 24 in the Senate. And that is an increase from the current count, which is 107 total women in Congress. But I think we also have to note that some of those women will lose their races. And so the percentage of women holding seats in Congress might actually not change all that much. On the other hand, a lot of these women who were running in primaries in particular, because of this anti-Trump sentiment that was sweeping the country, were first-time candidates, right? And what we do know is that the more comfortable that people get within the political system, maybe the more likely they are to do better the next time. So while they might have lost this primary, they might have a better grasp of local donors in their district, who to go to and hire the next time they run a campaign. So while the percentage of women in Congress may or may not shift in 2018, it could have effects in the next couple of election cycles. But I think there's a difference between women running and women actually winning the seats and it being a quote-unquote year of the woman.
A handful of special elections that have taken place over the last year has been characterized as a referendum on Trump.
On the fact that he doesn't represent most Americans, that his values don't line up with most Americans.
How do you see the numbers on the Trump question so far?
In quite a few races, candidates are leaning in, and even if they don't cite Trump's name in their ads are kind of Trumpy.
I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself.
They might say, build the wall, or we're going to deport illegals.
I'm Brian Kemp. If you want a politically incorrect conservative, that's me.
I think the reasons why some of these Republican candidates are perhaps trying to keep an arm's length distance from Trump is because there are certain traditional constituencies that are turned off by the president, say college-educated white women. who might be a sort of poachable entity for Democrats. So the thing that people should keep in mind is midterm elections, even if the president isn't coming up in every single commercial that you see on TV that's a political ad, voters are inherently thinking about what is going on in the White House in every election, not just with Trump's election. And you react to it and you say, oh, I like this guy and I like his party, or I don't like this guy and I don't like his party. And that might influence your vote.
Elephant in the room, one might say.
Yes.
Here's something else one might say.
This November election is more important than any midterm in our lifetime. The stakes that couldn't be...
Every single election is portrayed as the most important election of all time. I will say for the 2018 midterm elections, it really is the most important election of all time.
So do your numbers suggest a turnout that reflect the most important election of our lifetimes?
You're seeing pretty enthusiastic numbers from people saying, like, yes, I'm very pumped to vote, pumped to turn out. And I think particularly on the Democratic side, in certain races, they're hoping that Democratic turnout will kind of push them over the edge in states that are either purple or are red-tilting that voted for Trump in the election. So turnout is certainly an important factor in any election, but in midterm elections in particular, because they are typically lower turnout elections. And so these interesting pre-election surveys where we're seeing people be enthusiastic makes us think, oh, this might actually be, on both sides of the aisle, a pretty engaged midterm election.
The early voting numbers are way up.
Collin County, today's number exceeded the 2016 presidential election and shattered the turnout number for the last midterm election.
In North Carolina, the first 5 days saw more votes cast than in 2016. Same thing in Minnesota. The Secretary of State there said the level of participation is, quote, off the charts.
And this has been widely interpreted as suggesting that there is an, you know, ongoing insurgency among Democrats. Is there any evidence that the uptick in early voting is good news for Democratic candidates?
The very short answer is no. Early voting numbers are something that partisans and political operatives and campaigns really like to cite in the weeks coming up to the election as, look at this groundswell of support that we're seeing. But ultimately, they don't tell us much about who is going to be the ultimate winner of an election.
You know, in previous elections, there's always been so much focus on October surprises. Mm-hmm. And this election, just in the last week or so, has offered three such October surprises: the plummeting stock market, the bombs being sent to a number of Democrats and the media and other critics of the president, and the caravan, the Central American caravan working its way up through Mexico to the border. Are your numbers showing that these episodes are having any effect on the electorate?
Well, we don't have any numbers on the effect that these events have at all. So we can't say. What I would say was probably the October surprise was the Kavanaugh hearing. That is something that left people with lingering, strong feelings. You know, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with these bombing attempts over the next couple of weeks. I'm not sure what's going to happen with the caravan. Those two stories are really moving ones, and we don't have any real data yet to point and say, ah, yes, this has had an effect. You know, perhaps we will, you know, the week before the election. Trump is certainly trying to use the caravan to Republican advantage, although that's a sort of double-edged sword for him, because you might make an already enthused Democratic electorate more enthusiastic by, I guess, baiting them on that issue. And Democrats, we know, have gotten much more liberal on immigration. So I guess the shorter answer is we just don't know how the electorate is reacting to those things.
So I guess one final question.
Sure.
Does any of this matter? Are there still many minds not made up? And of those minds not made up, are they going to go to the polls in the first place? Do we have any idea of what would happen if the election were today?
Well, I would say even in the incredibly partisan year that is 2018, yes, there are still many people whose minds are not made up. There are moderate voters who are perhaps displeased with the current administration and who Democrats and Republicans have to make plays for, either by saying, give the middle finger to the White House, or come on home. You know that the Republican Party is where your true views lie.
Claire, thank you very much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Claire Malone is a senior political writer for 538. Coming up, the caravan, not an invasion, an exodus. This is On the Media.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For the past 2 weeks, little was known about the enormous human caravan wending its way toward the U.S.-Mexico border, except that it was a political bonanza for the Republican Party.
And remember, it's going to be an election of the caravan. You know what I'm talking about.
Donald Trump characterized the exodus as a horde of would-be illegal immigrants about to surge over our unprotected borders to take our jobs, flood our communities with gang activity and drugs, and, as a bonus, harbor Middle Eastern terrorists.
And is now obviously trying to conflate both Middle Eastern terror and illegal immigration in sort of a double racist sandwich.
We're going to put the safety of Americans in the hands of Mexico, Geraldo? No, never.
That, as opposed to the truth. Thousands of desperate people, many of them women and children in fear of their lives, taking advantage of safety in numbers and no need to pay parasitic coyote traffickers, yet destined to wait in line for weeks or months to apply for legal political asylum. Sarah Kenosian, a freelance reporter traveling with the caravan, has written for The Daily Beast about the cruel reality behind the surge of migrants. Not an invasion or a stunt to bait Donald Trump, but the desperate reaction to ongoing crisis in Honduras. Sarah, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Now, until the last couple of days, we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, it was kind of mysterious how this gigantic population of trekkers would so quickly coalesce, but we now know more. And it begins, I guess, with a guy named Bartolo Fuentes, a leftist former politician in Honduras. What was his role in all of this?
Well, to be honest, I think that Bartolo is sort of the second stage of this. According to Bartolo, and I have not been able to confirm this, there were other people who had planned much smaller caravans. He saw information about it on Facebook and decided to get in touch with those organizers. He has a lifetime of experience in facilitating immigration. And so he got in touch with them, verified it, and then he shared the post on Facebook. According to Bartolo, what happened was there was maybe 200, 300 people. And then there was this news report on Honduras' most watched cable news network called HCH.
Se va a ir caminando hacia los Estados Unidos.
Sí, buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.
That identified him as the leader.
Se llama Bartolo Fuentes. Él es uno de los que nos...
And that ultimately said that he would be paying for food and other costs for people.
Que le va a dar la comida y los demás gastos en este viaje.
Estamos esperando unas ayudas.
And he said from there he got tons and tons and tons of calls. But, you know, I don't think that's sort of the explanation. I think it helped start things and get them going. But then all of the other factors for why people migrate contribute to why it has snowballed in the way that it has. And that doesn't take away from the fact that this is an extraordinary amount of people. But he definitely credits that positive news report with the initial explosion.
On that report from HCH, here is what Bartolo Fuentes told you, and I'm reading from your story. In Honduras, the government wants to minimize why people are leaving. They know they're going to leave, and they want to say that they're doing so because of lies and the opposition, not the conditions that they, that is the government, created. This is in line with what the United States is saying, that there are false promises being made. And this pro-government news program played into that messaging, trying to say that there is financing when people really just need to get out. There is this right-wing media meme. It's actually video of caravan members being paid cash money. As the story is told, that it's you know, George Soros money or Democratic Party money bribing people to head northward to invade our borders.
The Democrats want caravans. They like the caravans. A lot of people say, I wonder who started that caravan.
But that has been debunked, has it not?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been multiple fact checks on it, first by Univision, by the New York Times, by Snopes. There is absolutely nothing to back up that George Soros was paying anyone on the caravan. I believe that it was local businessmen, and it was a very, very small amount of money that was passed out to them. And that's really not unusual, considering the local support that we're seeing for migrants here in Mexico, both in the towns once people get there, and then along the roadway, there's people passing out water, banana, clothes. Yesterday, in the town where the migrants settled, people came out and were giving out toys, underwear, all these sorts of different necessities. So you're really seeing a groundswell of local support for this caravan.
Now, what's interesting about that trope is that its origins seem to be the Honduran ambassador to the United States who sent that video footage to a Republican congressman who immediately tweeted it out and thereupon caught fire. So this is not only midterm politics playing out, it's Honduran domestic politics. Why would it be in the Honduran government's interest to plant that false explanation?
The explanation that I've seen mostly going around Honduras, and something that I've seen parroted by the chargé d'affaires, the closest thing to the ambassador that the United States has right now in Honduras, is that this is funded by the opposition of Honduras and that it is sort of a political game that people within the country are playing. That's sort of more the line that I've been seeing raised in Honduras, which makes sense. The country is extremely polarized, and then they just had a political crisis last year where there was a razor-thin election and the machines counting the votes shut down. And when they came back on, the lead of the opponent slowly started to slip away, and the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had been the incumbent, won power. And so critics allege that he stole the election, and it sort of threw the country into unrest. 30 people died in that shuffle, mostly killed by security forces. So the country has kind of grown in polarization since. So, you know, this sort of feeds that narrative with a president that's frankly facing quite a legitimacy crisis.
No, I know you have to go. Let me ask you one last question. Is there one story that you've encountered that you think kind of crystallizes the situation, the personal drama, the politics, and the fear?
I mean, you turn around and every person you ask has another story that really just makes their claims credible. I met somebody the other day who said that his son was killed by gangs. The son was 14. He made a claim to the police, and now he's fleeing for his life. He's afraid to come forward, you know, with his name or any of the details in the press because he's afraid of it, that his family back home will be killed.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Sarah Kenosian has been reporting on the migrant caravan for The Daily Beast. As thousands of people head for the U.S. border from Central America seeking refuge, they face a 1,000-mile gauntlet of hazards and the risk of getting stuck every step of the way. And the ability to proceed generally comes down to a matter of paperwork. Honduran passports, Guatemalan permission slips granting entry, your papers, please. Our state-issued paperwork is how we assert who we are and our rights to be where we are. A sort of guarantee from one government to another that the bearer is vouched for.
If you look at the document that many of us have, it'll say the Secretary of State of the United States requests that you provide this person facilitation and assistance, let them in and let them move without hindrance in your domains.
That, says CUNY Graduate Center Professor John Torpy, is what's known as the facilitative function of passports. But we more commonly think of their restrictive function, how they say where you can go and where you can't. According to Torpy, this restrictive function has its roots in serfdom and slavery.
a slave, for example, in the United States before 1865 would have had to have a pass in order to go abroad. Otherwise, he would be regarded as a potential runaway slave and captured and returned to his or her owner. We experienced in the 19th century a kind of transformation because those forms of labor control were more or less eliminated. So there was a so-called exit revolution, and people were increasingly allowed to move around, and that helped to facilitate a huge migration to the Americas, not just to the United States, but also to Latin America and particularly to Argentina.
So at the heart of it, I was kind of surprised to learn, is economic security, labor security. But I was also kind of surprised to realize that the restriction on external travel by states is a relatively new development. Ben Franklin didn't need a passport to be the toast of Paris. He just showed up. What changed in the 19th century to make government-issued documents necessary?
This exit revolution took place, and the idea of nationalism increasingly took hold. The idea was that states were the peculiar possession of particular groups of people called nations. The idea is that a certain group of people has a right to control the state, and often that was construed in ethnic terms. And so increasingly, there was a kind of concern about whether these other people over here should be allowed to come into our domains. And that became a stronger concern as ordinary people were given the vote. As more and more people have access to the ballot box, it matters kind of who they are and whether they are people that we can count on. Are they people who might bear us ill will? So increasingly, the concern outside of wartime became, you know, who gets in? Whereas till, say, the mid-19th century, it had primarily been a question of who got out.
Now, the consolidation of nation-states in the 19th century you described and the documentation of citizenship that came with that has created a collateral damage in the form of statelessness. It is a big problem throughout the world.
Now, more than 10 million people do not have a country they legally belong to. They're known as the stateless ones.
From Myanmar to the United Arab Emirates to Palestine. But it isn't new. Tell me about not just statelessness, but passportlessness.
Often, these kinds of problems arise when there's major political upheaval. So World War I is a key moment in the sense that there's the collapse of these European land empires, the Russian Empire under the pressure of the Bolshevik Revolution, the Ottoman Empire, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And all of a sudden, all these people are kind of set adrift, and they don't necessarily have the documents that they now need in order to enter some other state. In those days, there was the League of Nations that basically decided to give the authority to a man named Fridtjof Nansen, who was a Norwegian explorer and humanitarian. He was named the League of Nations High Commissioner for Russian Refugees. And because this was such a widespread problem, he was given the authority to issue a document in his own name. It was called the Nansen Passport, so that people would have the kind of documents that they need. And subsequently, the UN has done the same kind of thing, issued papers to people who need them. It's clearly been recognized, especially since World War I, that statelessness is a condition of considerable vulnerability. And if you lack the documents you need corresponding to statelessness, that makes your situation that much more difficult.
It's been an issue in the United States at the U.S.-Mexico border.
An immigration crackdown, this time on U.S. citizens. State Department reportedly denying or revoking passports from some Americans living along the southern border, accusing hundreds of Hispanics of using fake birth certificates. We're going to speak to the report.
The recent cases that were reported by the Washington Post have to do with people about whom there was some doubt that they were actually born in the United States and that there were falsifications of birth documents by midwives who were involved in the birth of those people. I mean, the basic underlying issue is, are these people citizens? That is, were they really born on the territory of the United States, which, you know, in our law, accords them citizenship?
Whatever the circumstances were of falsification of papers by midwives or not, suddenly these people have no access to a passport. They haven't got a Mexican passport. And therefore, are they, even though they were most likely born within our borders, some sort of undefined other?
this is why, in a way, I got interested in this whole phenomenon of passports. We're not born with our citizenship stamped on our forehead. It can only really be made effective with these kinds of documents. So if they can't get access to the documents, they are indeed in a difficult legal limbo. I mean, the United States has also, particularly in the mid-20th century, denied passports to people on political grounds. I mean, it very frequently denied passports to people who were members of the Communist Party, thought to be connected to the Communist Party, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, it's utterly unsurprising that the passport has become, apart from a means of documentation, proof of origin and everything else, a commodity. It's a hot ticket for a variety of reasons, including, as it turns out, countries themselves that want to deal with the population that they don't want to make full members of the society.
Selling of citizenship is something that's been taking off. Certain countries in the Mediterranean, in Cyprus, in Malta, and other countries, they're taking in people who are basically buying citizenship, who are making a contribution of some sort.
How much does it cost to get a citizenship?
$100,000.
You have to come and live in Dominica?
No. You don't even have to come to Dominica to get the citizenship. You pay the money from wherever you are.
Sort of mail order citizenship.
Sort of, something like that.
So as the passport becomes more of a commodity, whether by individuals seeking certain benefits or by countries trying to offload responsibilities, is the passport as a mechanism at risk of being muddied by the free market for place?
There's long been a market in passports.
The disappearance of Flight 370 is shining a light on the business of passport theft. Don, good morning.
Because some get you into lots of countries. The American passport, for example, will get you into lots of countries without a visa. And if you're from, I don't know, Nigeria or Senegal, your passport doesn't open as many visa-free doors. I think the market that we're talking about is really, in a way, a market for the underlying commodity, which is citizenship. Citizenship has long been seen as a kind of sacred possession. It's about patriotism. It's about devotion to your country. It's about commitment to your fellow citizens. And the idea that you can simply buy one is seen accordingly as a kind of cheapening of that sacred possession.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John C. Torpy is director of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and author of The Invention of the Passport, Surveillance, Citizenship, and the State. Coming up, homeopathic politics. Battling attack ads with doses of the ads themselves. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Election Day, Massachusetts citizens will weigh in on a referendum known as Question 3. A yes vote preserves existing protections for trans individuals against discrimination in public spaces. A no vote returns the state to its pre-2016 status quo, in which transgender was not a legally protected class. The messaging on the no side of Question 3 has featured the sort of scare tactics you might expect in such a key battle within the American culture wars, including this attack ad produced by the No on 3 campaign.
What does Massachusetts Question 3 mean to you? It means any man who says he is a woman can enter a woman's locker room, dressing room, or bathroom at any time. Vote No on 3. This bathroom bill puts our privacy and safety at risk. It goes too far.
It's an almost comically anti-trans video, but in a remarkable exercise in political homeopathy, the activists on the other side of the question, many themselves trans, went door to door to share that ad with potential voters. It was not a random tactic. It emerged based on the work of Stanford professor David Brockman,
who a few years ago in Florida, on another trans-related ballot question, began applying his research findings to supercharge the age-old political process of door-to-door canvassing by just plain talking to the person who answers the door.
Now, a lot of people have skepticism about this kind of approach because they say, well, there's no way that you could knock on a stranger's door and get them to talk to you, much less tell these kinds of stories. But what we actually found in the research is that canvassers who had just gone through a simple morning training were able to have conversations where the vast majority of voters who were home opened the door, had the conversation, and told a story from their life. So I think our fellow Americans are actually remarkably open to reflecting and thinking about their political views, about these kinds of topics, if they're approached in such a way from a friendly person who is open and wants to have that kind of conversation with them.
So once you've initiated the perspective having, what's the effect? The person becomes suddenly more open to other outgroups like trans citizens?
Just like clinical trials for medicine, where you'd randomly assign patients to a blood pressure pill or a sugar pill, we did the same thing in this study where we randomly assigned voters to either get the kind of perspective-taking intervention that I mentioned or a control group that got a door knock about recycling. What we find when we do a series of follow-up surveys, 3 days, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, and 3 months later, is that when we compare the group that we had the conversation with at the door versus the group we could have but did not, that treatment group is significantly more accepting of transgender people across a variety of items. The average effect is on the order of about 15 percentage points, if you had to put it in those terms. Another way to think about it is that if you look at the change on items that measure attitudes towards gay men and lesbians and the average attitudes in 1998 and 2012, we see a similar effect from these 10, 20-minute conversations as we see in the public in general from 1998 to 2012. So that's a really, really big effect.
Does this inoculate them against political advertising that engages in hateful hot-button pressing?
One thing we actually did in one of the follow-up surveys is actually show the voters in both the treatment and control groups one of those transphobic advertisements to say, well, if we show them these ads, is the effect of the canvas going to, say, go away as everyone retreats into a transphobic corner? Although we do find the ad has some immediate effect, we still find the treatment group we canvassed is much more supportive. Moreover, several weeks later, it seems as though the effect of the ad has completely evanesced. What we find time and again is that the effects of those kinds of mass media advertisements are very ephemeral.
Now, doesn't your research fly in the face of academic orthodoxy on the matter of campaign theory?
We're actually entering this really interesting period, which is sort of like when medicine moved from putting leeches on people and telling anecdotes like, well, I put a leech on Mary and Mary got better, so you should put a leech on yourself too. We're kind of still, I would say, in the early days of using these rigorous, real-world randomized trials that revolutionized medicine. So there's different versions of orthodoxy depending on who you subscribe to, but my personal view is that we actually just know remarkably little about the real-world impacts of this kind of campaign activity. I don't think our study is going to be the last word on the matter. It's much more like one of the first words on the matter of this particular kind of intervention. But we're doing lots of follow-up work on other issues like immigration, abortion, to kind of flesh out our understanding of this.
TV campaigns reach a lot of people. And door-to-door canvassing is limited to the number of volunteers you have to fan out in a community, which is why the campaign industrial complex is built around television advertising. So let's just say the effects that you found in your studies hold true through subsequent studies and become the received wisdom of political campaigning. There's still the problem of seeing enough individual voters at their doorsteps to really have any effect.
There actually are plenty of political campaigns, the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, the Beto O'Rourke campaign right now in Texas, and many others who have succeeded in recruiting just a huge number of volunteers to go talk to their neighbors and knock on doors. So from my perspective, if campaigns don't try and really think about the art and science of recruiting volunteers and building a team to talk to their neighbors, then it's no surprise that if they don't make a good try at it, they're not going to have much success. And in terms of the dollars and cents of it, I think it's also a vision of American democracy that normatively we might like a little better too. You don't need a big campaign budget or to do lots of fundraisers with rich donors to be able to bankroll a serious field team. What you need is a candidate or a cause that many kinds of engaged individuals want to go volunteer their time to spread the word about.
In 2 weeks' time, we'll know how Massachusetts voted on question three. Will that tell us anything definitive about inoculation? Is there some way that we could find ourselves on sounder statistical footing on the subject of inoculation, or are we going to have to wait for still more peer-reviewed social science to materialize?
I would really resist the temptation to generalize too much from any particular election result. That's kind of the trap that the research on campaigns and elections and campaign consulting has been in for 100 years. What we really would like to know is what would have happened in the campaign if they had done something else, which of course we can't know because the campaign only happened a particular way. So that's why we need these kinds of rigorous clinical trials to randomly assign voters or districts or whatever else to say, we can actually see what happens when we do this and when we don't.
Yeah, but just between you and me, should I be like investing heavily in clipboard futures?
Well, I think what we tend to see in other industries is that as new ideas and innovations come out of academia, they diffuse over time and relatively slowly into the real world. So I don't know that I think that campaigns will or even necessarily should be taking this one study we have and, you know, reorienting all their activities around it within the next year. I hope on the scale of 10 or 20 years, we'll have built up the kind of evidence base that is very persuasive and rigorous, and that prejudice reduction advocates will be interested in applying in their work.
David, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
David Brockman is a political scientist at the Graduate Business School of Stanford University. Matt Collette has been reporting on the Question 3 campaign for the WNYC podcast, Nancy. Matt, welcome to OTM.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
All right, so in the late summer, you went up to Massachusetts, and you tagged along with the door-to-door campaign in support of yes on Question 3, that is to say, yes, keep these laws on the books. What did that campaign look like?
So it's this like super enthusiastic, super grassroots organization, which is a word people use a lot. But like these volunteer sessions began and ended with things that sort of doubled as training sessions and like we're all going to be okay group therapy sessions.
So here are some tips for you as you're heading out the turf. One is be tenacious, which means keep going. And if someone comes to the door, assume that they are at least interested enough to answer the door. So don't give them that space to say no or to say I'm busy. So instead of saying, do you have time, just launch into your script.
Hey, good morning. I'm looking for Beatrice or Joseph.
Yeah, my Joseph.
Oh, that's fine. My name's Dee. I'm with the Yes on Three campaign, which is the campaign to protect transgender equality in Massachusetts.
After you reach a certain point in the conversation, you say like, hey, here's this ballot question. How are you going to vote on it? Here's how it's going to affect me personally or affect people I know. They then ask,
I know that this is an issue that's been getting a lot of attention lately in like the press and just sort of in general. Have you heard anything in the news or on social media or just in a face-to-face conversation that's given you any hesitation or doubt about your vote?
And they're basically trying to fish for concerns. A lot of times coming with these ballot questions are concerns and fears that get raised and get propagated about sex offenders in bathrooms and men just taking advantage of these laws to pretend that they are transgender, pretend to go into women's restrooms just so they can lurk in there. Then they take out a tablet computer and say, there's actually been ads.
They made an ad just about this, and I'd love to show it to you.
Sexual predators in women's bathrooms think it can't happen.
So yeah, here's the thing that they call inoculation, which is basically exposing in a controlled dose this opposition message, which they know it's really likely that this voter could encounter, you know, on Facebook or when they're watching the news. And what they want to do is administer this opposition message in a controlled environment where the voter isn't alone, where they're not seeing a bunch of other comments on Facebook. They can encounter this with somebody there to walk them through it and help pull them back from the brink. It's a lot like getting a flu vaccine where your body gets a tiny, tiny bit of the flu virus, and the white blood cells in your blood just are like, oh, okay, we know what to do in case we encounter it later.
Vote no on three. This bathroom bill puts our privacy and safety at risk. It goes too far.
It's like, what did you think about that? Does it raise any concerns for you?
No, but in a way, not to offend the transgender people or whatever you want to call us, It would be better, I think, for both of you, both sides to have their own bathroom.
Interesting.
So, in other words, you people are going to be criticized or whatever, name calling or whatever they want to do, and the other people will just be able to keep their mouth shut.
Right. I hear what you're saying. So you're sort of saying that transgender people should have their own place to go just so they can kind of be spared from people who might have a problem with it?
Well, just the bathrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going out to eat, no, there should be no problem.
Right. Yeah.
At all. But I think in places like that, so the transgender doesn't get upset or somebody doesn't start yelling, screaming for police or whatever.
Right. That's a really interesting perspective, and I don't think I've heard it phrased quite that way before. It makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Something that's complicated about it, I think, is that there are a lot of transgender people who you wouldn't know were transgender walking down the street, if you know what I mean. I think it gets a little dicey where you draw the line, if you know what I mean.
Beatrice, at the start of this conversation, you know, she was confused at first about the wording of the question, but then was like, oh yeah, I'd vote yes. I support equal rights for everybody. It's sort of a thing everybody can kind of agree on. And then she suddenly introduced this idea that this could allow sex offenders and criminals to take advantage of this weak law and put her grandkids at risk. And then she suddenly starts to weigh a bunch of things. On one hand, she says, like, she used to be a nurse and she would have never turned away a transgender person. At the same time, she's like, ever since I was a little kid, I went to Catholic school and, like, there were boys' rooms and girls' rooms. And that's just, like, how the world has worked all along.
When the canvasser, Dee, left Beatrice's house, what was the net-net of the conversation?
So at the end, Dee has to ask the same question she asked at the beginning. How are you going to vote on this?
When our non-discrimination law is on the ballot, will you vote yes to keep these protections or vote no to repeal them?
Yes.
The vote yes. And would you say definitely yes or probably yes?
Yes.
Right. Thank you.
Everybody has their own life to live, and how they're going to live is their business.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
I really appreciate it.
How do you feel that went?
It went well. What she was saying about having different restrooms for transgender people, like the words like separate but equal crossed through my head, and that's not really necessarily the right argument to bring to her because it's, you know, we don't want to be too confrontational while we're doing this work. Because we can't bring somebody all the way. But she was somebody, she was a nice lady, definitely a good conversation.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where to next?
Let me take one second. Yeah. I'm going to call some of my...
I don't know. I left feeling a little more skeptical. Some conversations, I definitely felt certain. I was like, yep, this sort of inoculation idea has happened. But I think a lot of times it can be messy and you leave people with like a storm of ideas that maybe aren't completely resolved. And some of it, like, you're not going to resolve in a 10 or 15 minute conversation with a stranger at your door. And maybe it planted a seed. And now as Beatrice sees this in the news, sees it in the newspaper, sees a commercial like this, she'll understand the context to which it exists, but it's also possible that she'll never really think of this again.
Now, this is all an interesting bit of political science and campaign strategy speculation at the moment, but it's also something particularly of the moment. The Trump administration apparently is working on a workaround so that transgender as a category of citizen effectively will cease to be, and then therefore any particular protections rendered moot. Does that add urgency to the Question 3 campaign?
My theory going into this, and what I heard from people on the ground there, is that basically if this loses in Massachusetts, anti-trans activists all over the country can go around and they can say, if liberal Massachusetts doesn't want these protections, why should we have them in Wyoming or West Virginia or anywhere that these come up for debate?
So, too far out of the mainstream, even for the People's Republic of Massachusetts.
Exactly. I think the other thing is that it took a long time for the gay rights movement to get to a point where they had majority support. It can be really hard to get a majority of people to vote for a minority, especially if they don't know them or if they don't understand them. The trans community is so much smaller than the gay and lesbian community, I think it can be even harder to move the needle. So if a strategy like this inoculation thing works, or at least shows us a new angle that might be able to be taken in the LGBT and queer rights movement, it's promising. I don't know that it might work as well on an issue like abortion that a lot of people have thought a lot about and made up their minds. I think that's where the research wants to see where you can continue this. But right now, I think it works on something that people haven't actually given a lot of thought to in the first place.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Matt Collette is the senior producer of Nancy, a podcast about all things LGBTQ, made right here in our producing station, WNYC. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi and Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.